Well, we've got a question here from a man that says, please explain the shall we die, and a minister in this area used this with the passage of Revelation that says, I will not blot out his name from the book of life. And the beast, he teaches that your name can be blotted out of the Lamb's book of life. No name can be added, but your name can be blotted out. Well, this is erroneous because it comes from an area of this translation. In fact, in the Fenton version, I think it's in this, concerning this, this is the fifth study. This is the third chapter of the book of Revelation. Now, the King James Version says, he that overcometh, the same shall be clothed with white raiment. And I will not blot his name out of the book of life, because I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. Now, this is a positive statement. In the Fenton Version, it uses the word erase. And it says, to him that overcometh, will I give to him the white raiment of righteousness, because his name is written in the book of life, from whence it can never be erased. And so this is the King James translation reverses it, but still reads it positive, but the other, from whence it can never be erased. And of course, we realize it couldn't be erased, because in the book of, in the book of Romans, why we have the statement concerning the fact that those he did foreknow, he did predestinate to conform the image of his Son. And so he starts through on a positive program and have his, elected the elect before the foundation of the world, ordained that they would be eventually in his own image and righteousness and perfection. It would be a very foolish thing then to say that they could be erased. In fact, the scriptures also cite that he was the Lamb of God slain before the foundation of the world, and that his children were destined to arise in his own image, and eventually in the climax of his coming they were going to put on his righteousness. And so to try to say that anyone had to have their name erased out of the book of life would be very, very foolish. Over in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, it says that the people would look and wonder at the beast whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. So if God established the book of life in the foundation of the world, and he wrote names, your names and my name, into the book of life, the foundation of the world, it was permanent, it was predestinated, it was the sovereign purpose of God, or he wouldn't have written it there to begin with. Because the book of life is permanently an eternal pattern of life. And so, in the area of referring to the soul that sinners shall surely die, the fact is that, again, we have a pattern of translation. The wages of sin is death, and death comes on all men. Thus, the word of the breath of life is what is passes out of men, and they die because of the transgression which started with the Adamic race, and the whole race died. But at the same time, with the resurrection of Christ, why Christ died for the entire race, and the whole race puts back on life or immortality, so that they will share in his resurrection, and in his coming they will be raised from the dead. And so again, the soul that sinners shall surely die is again the breath of life leaves man because of his transgression. But it doesn't necessarily mean his transgression as much as racial transgression, though he is in part a portion of the fallen society. Now, this other question here is, we would like a brief explanation of British Israel and its history. It is used to discredit anyone that's on the track of identity. The Don Bell, as we read the Don Bell reports, and he has a lot to learn on Israel, so I don't feel he has even authority. Well, of course, the areas of identity and the identity of Israel as the white race is a biblical truth, and it isn't necessarily belonging to any individual group or organization. The enemy that likes to oppose it would call it a cult, but it doesn't belong in this fashion to any particular group. They taught the identity of Israel back in the days when Joseph of Arimathea owned the tin mines of Cornwall and built the church at Glastonbury, Mary lived at Glastonbury, and that's where the Church of the Christ had his hands building. But he had given the 10 hides of land at Glastonbury for the great abbotry. And in that day, why they taught the fact that the peoples of Britain had descended from Israel, and that this was their coming to the Messiah and so forth. All through the history of the British Empire, why Episcopalians and Presbyterians and all of the elite clergy that understood the archaeology in the background of Britain taught the fact that the Anglo-Saxon people were Israel. And because they taught this, why it was referred to as British Israel. But they didn't stop here. They also taught that the Scandinavians were Israel. And of course, many of them realized that the entire white race was Israel as well. So there was a group that called themselves the Anglo-Saxon World Federation, and they taught that the English was the closest language to original Hebrew, which it is, and so forth, and they became a very powerful moving institution, and as such, they put out many books. And of course, there was the British Israel World Association, which taught that the British were Israel, and of course, the Covenant Man organization, and British means Covenant Man, and so forth. So these were strictly separate organizations, institutions, but the doctrine of identity, which means the identity of the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, Nordic, Basque, and Lombard people with Israel, is one of those doctrines that the Bible students all know and all understand. So as far as Don Bell is concerned, he follows the same fantasy as do a lot of orthodoxy that do not recognize the House of Israel. And of course, I suppose he believes that any man can be saved, irrespective of his origin. And of course, whereas Don Bell is exposing the Jews, I suppose he imagines that the Jews are somehow related to Israel, which they're not, never were, never will be. And of course, Christ proves this with the affidavit that they were of their father the devil, and the lust of their father that they would do. Traces them to the generations of the serpent and the viper. All the people who do not teach that the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, Nordic, Basque, and Lombard peoples are Israel, teach the Jews are Israel, but they've fallen from the hand of God, and that God had to cast them aside, and he selected everybody on the face of the earth who would accept him through his church, and that the church is spiritual Israel and so forth, which is a fantasy and a fallacy. The church is Israel because it's founded in the nations of Israel. It's the spiritually alive heart of Israel. And of course, God founded this church as an eternal institution to carry on the work of as he did in the Old Testament with the Kehillah or church in the Old Testament, as the assembly, as they're coming together, as the place of worship and so forth. But as far as Israel is concerned, why Israel still are nations before him, even forever. And in the entire New Testament, Israel is the one to whom he gave the covenant, to whom he gave the promises, he gave the law, he gave the glories of God, the position of his sons. And so every promise in this book is given to Israel, and if we claim any promises, we have to be Israel, or we're claiming promises that don't even belong to us. So I think that would take care of these questions. Actually, someone says, I want the history of British Israel, and you just have to get the history of the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, Nordic, Basque, and Lombard race, because it was not a theology in itself. It was an all-encompassing truth concerning the development of these peoples to fulfill the prophecies which God gave to Israel and to which they are, of course, part. Now, let me see here. We may have another question here. No, that's no question. Do we have another question? Does anyone out here have a question?
What are the different ages? You hear people talk about the church age and the age of grace.
Well, this is, of course, is a little out of ordinary. The age of grace is not a particular period of time. The Bible doesn't talk about the age of grace. It tells us that God deals with us always with grace. He dealt with Israel in grace. In fact, if it had not been for his grace, why Israel would have fallen by the very law given to them, because the law was a condemnation, and the law brought with him its judgments. God dealt with Israel with grace. In fact, the one area where Moses talks about the laws of God and the grace of God still follows them, and it says, except, of course, he forgave them for their transgressions and for their not keeping the law, with the exception, of course, of the one transgression that you couldn't blot out. And this is when a man took to himself a stranger wife and then begat unto them children, and the descent, which were of another race, and the sins of the father descended on the children to the third, the fourth, the fifth generation. And whereas God can accept back the man, possibly, yet still at the same time these children had no affinity with Israel, and they were a mongrel, off-breed people, and no amount of grace could change the pattern that they had no part nor lot in the house of Israel. But as far as God's grace is concerned, why grace is the program of God to not only to forgive sins, but to carry forward the entire processes of his administering program of gifts, because the gifts of God are without calling, without repentance. You don't earn a gift. A gift is bestowed on you, and the gift comes from the grace of God. In other words, grace of God is unwarranted favor from the standpoint of having earned it. And so therefore, all the favor of God is shown his grace for his household is unwarranted. We can't say we have this coming to us, but we can, by the grace of God, we have these things coming, because God and his grace is triumphant. There's no bigger word in the entire Bible than the word grace, because this is the very nature of God himself, to bestow grace on his household and on his family. We talk about the age of grace, and theology generally concedes that the age of the church was the age of grace. Whereas they like to talk about the age of the law, God dealt always with Israel with grace. In fact, when he said he was going to divorce Israel, and then he says, but now he finally comes out and says, well, now show me the bill of divorcement. Can any man establish for me the divorcement? Show me the bill, for I'm married to Israel, and so forth. So God deals with grace always and constantly. And of course, the New Testament program, where he pours his Holy Spirit out on the house of Israel and upon the people that comprise his church, this is an act of grace. But he said in the 31st chapter of Jeremiah that he was going to do this, and that he didn't refer to it himself as an age of grace. He said, I deal with you always with grace. And we believe that he does. In fact, the grace of God, without any question, is the one area of theology that has a magnitude that no man can encompass. Well, you got a question?
What do you think of the idea that in the plans of spirit that, there isn't any marriage here in the plans of spirit?
There isn't?
Right?
No. Go ahead.
Okay, well, what do you think of the idea that the male and female merge in as one spirit?
No, they never do. This comes out of the concept that God removed Eve from Adam and formed her, but she became a living soul as well. When God begat Adam in his own image, after his own likeness, he was only begatting the physical vessel that the spirits of the eternal children would come into. So therefore, when he begat Adam in his own image, a son of his out of the spirit entered into Adam. Adam was what was he was called, because this was the first man and he was the Adamic race. He was called Adam. Then God separated a portion of Adam out of Adam and made Eve. Now Eve also then received a living spirit or a living soul. Now when this was because there was no people on the face of the earth that Adam could join himself to, God did not produce two. He produced the one and took woman out of Adam, but gave her also a living spirit. Now they can be one flesh, but they are different spirits. And any idea that anyone could possibly have would be very, very foolish, to think that that because the woman marries a man, they are one spirit. They are one spirit as you and Christ are one spirit, in that the spirits that are in us all proceeded forth out of God. But they are definitely children of the Most High, which came in with a separate entity. And this would be a rather strange thing. Man might have four or five wives. Then his spirits would be really divided up. The thing is that the woman has a spirit of her own, and she doesn't have to wait till she gets married to have a spirit. And the spirits are not one, other than they are one in companionship or one in Christ. But they are definitely separate entities. The physical consciousness today, of course, the entire race has merged out of Adam, and so this is. Now a matter of genealogy, but the pattern still is that a woman and all women, like all men, are separately begotten today, whereas Eve was taken out of Adam to begin with, that they might continue as one flesh and be one flesh, and the whole race would emerge as one flesh. But if this is what you're talking about, well, it doesn't have any connection.
Well, why is it? Is there a place in the Bible that talks about daughters of God as well as sons?
The word children of God is used where lots of times it's translated in the King James Version sons.
And that means both.
Yeah, this would mean both people. For instance, we have women judges like Ruth and these others, and I mean these people are just as much an entity. It's a conceited concept on the part of man to think that only he has spirit.
No, that wasn't.
No, but it is. Still, it is.
No, what I Well, why has it been, for instance, that throughout the Old Testament, especially the sons were the only ones that were really
because the fathers are the head of the family. Patriarchal law establishes this: the fathers were the head of the family, and they named sons because the name only continued down through the sons. And the women always were married, took on the name of another man. So they always named the descendancy of a family through the father and the sons. This is the only thing that there is not. Yes?
His question about the mind for me. In one of the New Testament, the Pharisees are questioning Christ, and they bring up the question of man, and those times a man that died, his wife could be married to the man's brother. And since the third woman was married to one man, he died. His brother took her to wife, he died. His brother took her to wife, so she had three husbands in life. Then she died. Which one is her husband in death? And Christ answered,
Yeah. Well, the fact is that when the laws of Israel said that if a man's brother had raised no seed up unto a woman, that he could then take this woman as to wife. Because remember that plural marriages were customary in the Old Testament. And this is nothing wrong with the plural marriage under the Old Testament pattern of law. A man might have one wife, two wives, three wives, four wives, five wives, say. A man took to himself his brother's wife if his brother died and he had raised no children, see. This was, and so this is where this law was. Now, the Sadducees were reincarnationists. So they thought that they were going to pin Christ because in reincarnation they don't care, there's no resurrection of the same body, they just keep on going on and on. Whereas the Pharisees are children of the resurrection, Moses is a teacher of resurrection. Job, way back there, 5,000 B.C., taught resurrection, and he would rise, and with these very eyes, he would behold God. So this is the place where this passage is. At this time, when Christ was talking, when they died, they went into the netherworld, where they were held by Lucifer anyhow until the hour of resurrection. So Sadducees were arguing that who would a wife be then if she had been married to three different men, but she would never be married to three different men. Well, she could in this circumstance, but then this was a posterity seed factor, and naturally she would go to the first husband which she had had. This is why a brother had to be one in the family to even take her to wife, see? And so Jesus said answered them that they would be like they were in the kingdom of heaven. Now, this is where he said they were near the marriage, they're giving the marriage. Now, this happens to be a particular passage, which in turn is translated around the throne. Seraphims were around the throne. And the seraphims and cherubs surrounded the area where the throne of God existed. And these were angels that had been created without carrying either sex nor gender. And they didn't multiply and they didn't increase. That was the cherubims and the seraphims around the throne. But the anointed cherub that covereth didn't keep his first estate, which was when Lucifer sowed his seed out among these other people as well. But when he said that until the kingdom had been organized, or until they got back again into the function of the kingdom, why, when they died, they would be as they were in the surrounding the throne. They would be neither marriage or giving a marriage as far as physical bodies were concerned. The spiritual realm was not begatting physical bodies until the spiritual realm and the physical world became one again, see. And so with this pattern, now we do have cosmic conception, and we have all types of areas of increase, but these things that have happened in the heavens. And of course, within this process, why the eye doesn't see nor does the ear heard all the things that relate to the society of the celestials, but we do know that in this world we beget and raise children, and therefore when they died they went into heaven. If they would be as it was with the cherubs and the seraphims until they were once more restored or resurrected in the earth. And so again, this is only an argumentative point that they brought out with Christ, because they've been reincarnationists. They just come back and marry and die and marry again and die and marry again. And this was why they thought they had a choice area of philosophy that they could run through on Christ. In fact, in the Darby version, this does not even occur, so you can't tell whether it was actually. This passage isn't there, and we don't know whether it was there or whether they put it in. Say, but it's sensible. Another question.
Problem in the whole spectrum of religion, from atheism to free agency to preordination to predestination. These are all, I mean, it's a very broad subject. I realize we've talked on it for a week, but could you kind of clarify what your feelings are regarding, I wouldn't consider atheism or the too much free agency, but the other area is preordination.
I don't know what your question is. In the first place, an atheist is somebody who's mentally sick with a vacuum in his head. An agnostic or an atheist is not a rule. He's not the course of the general pattern of the life of our race. Even the pagans worship God. But you do have a people with a sort of a mental vacuum. They somehow have been a casualty that say they're atheists, and yet these atheists will cry out to God in their hours of emergency. These atheists don't remain atheists, generally speaking. They tried to say that Darwin was an atheist, but Darwin wasn't an atheist. He decided to please God. He hoped that people could understand that he was only suggesting this as a theory. So here again, Clarence Darrow was an atheist, but Clarence Darrow was still caught himself calling on God in several emergencies. Ingersoll called on God in a thunderstorm. In fact, at one time he had been going out on this storm, and he had made a speech in a place in upstate New York, in Plattsburgh, and he said that if there was a God in heaven, a thunderstorm was coming up, and he was one of the speakers. He'd been speaking here. He said, "Well, if there's a God in heaven, he can strike me dead right now." Say, but God didn't bother to do it. Say. But anyhow, on the way home from this, he was riding in his buggy, and a most terrific, violent thunderstorm came up. And he got out of it with a couple of other men, and they got over under a great big tree. And God struck that tree, and it dazed them, and Ingersoll fell down and started to pray. So you see, an atheist and an agnostic are a kind of a mental void and a kind of a sickness and a disease. We're not going to classify them. Now, there isn't any such thing as free agency. Free agency is totally removed from the areas of Scripture. God says the only one that's free has been set free by Christ. He doesn't talk about a free agency. He says, "My Spirit calls my sheep by name. I lead them out. I give them eternal life. They never perish." The program of predestination was referred to as a God having selected his children to come down and reside in physical bodies. He said even the time of their coming into this world, he ordained that they would be his elect. And in the course of this, it says all Israel shall be saved, as is written, going to justify them, going to glorify them. He says eventually all flesh will be saved. But to these things, God is the sovereign. God is master. God says, "I work all these things out according to the counsel of my will." So we don't have a vast range in theology between free agency and areas and degrees of predestination. We have the fact that God is sovereign, God predestinates. He cites it in Ephesians, that he not only is predestinated to conform the image of the Son, but he talks about our inheritance in him. And so we turn here, for instance, to this passage. Now, he says over here in the first chapter of Ephesians, "Having made known unto us the mystery of his will, according to the good pleasure which he hath purposed in himself, that in the dispensation of the fullness of time, that he would gather together in one all things through Christ, which are in heaven and which are in earth, even through him, in whom also we have obtained an inheritance, being predestinated according to the purpose of him who worketh out all things according to the counsel of his will." So, actually, when we deal with the scriptures in Old and New Testament, God says, "According to the counsel of my will." There are He chastens and chastises the people that disobey. He punishes the wicked and so forth. But the foot, and he even cites that there's no place you can go. Where could you go? Could you go to the bottom of the sea? Could you go to the heights of the mountains? Could you go into the abysses of the netherworld? Where could you go? He says that I can't find you. I'll find you, he says. So therefore, he says that that all things work out according to the counsel of his will. Predestination is a prerogative of God, and in the fullness of time, he will bring even the most wayward individual back into his grace and back into the object of receiving his grace. And so even Lucifer is going to worship at your feet. And when Lucifer worships at your feet, he ceases to become Satan and the devil, which have been destroyed. And the Shekinah glory of God is the consuming flame, and emerges again an archangel restored back to God, who invested an archangel in it in the course of history and time. So again, we discover that this is according to the counsel of his will. And someone says, well, that means that eventually everyone will be saved. That's right. And anyone that can establish that the grace of God isn't sufficient for that and can't save to the uttermost has a smaller God, a littler theology, and he's just unfortunate. We have today the Arminian teaching in theology, and the monk Arminian was teaching that people could be saved today, lost tomorrow, saved again, and God says, I give them eternal life and they never perish, and he was fighting this area of grace. And so he brought out the doctrines which were enveloped in the Catholic Church's doctrine, which even had areas of salvation, and it required great penance and tremendous work for people to stay saved, and the church sold them special dispensations and special works of grace, and when they passed it, when they died, they could go into limbo, and they were headed into purgatory, and then down through after limbo they went into purgatory. And then from purgatory they could go into hell, but nothing could stand still. They were sliding back. And then the people that were on earth also could help the people that were sliding back by putting plenty of contributions into the church and raising his money for high masses and so forth. And this was nothing but Babylonian mimicry. This was a factitious deal, but they never had a concept of this until they got the idea that you could be saved today or lost tomorrow. And the priest saw that this would work out with this Jewish overloading of priests moving into the Catholic Church, why they moved in, and this is what they started. And today, all the areas of grace in the Catholic Church which are sold or are merchandised by the Church come out of this fictitious doctrine. Is there another question?
On that same point, what you mentioned, and I've heard it before, where you said that God considers the mongrels are offspring of mixed races as dumb. Well, in the case where Lucifer's seed on earth is a mongrelization, is this offspring considered flesh or dung as far as salvation?
God talks about them. He says, I consider them as the dung of asses and horses.
And
these are the mongrelized offspring. Now, don't think for a moment that Lucifer is the father of all the races of people that are against him. The Chinese were a people. The Chinese were one of the original creations of Earth. There's millions and millions of Chinese. They're not the children of Lucifer, but they've selected him as God. He controls their minds. But they have as their priests Lucifer's children, because the majority of priests are Jews in the Buddhist faith, for instance, or in the Gautamism that they used to have, or in Brahma, Vishnu, Siva, or Kali, see. So today the Jews are Lucifer's children, whether they're black ones, whether they're green ones, whether they're orange ones, they're still Jews. Now, for instance, this I want to point out to you, and that is that in the Los Angeles newspaper for last Sunday, for instance, it says Israel faces a new testing time. Now, why is it facing a new testing time? Well, the problem is, and it is a major problem, they said, is becoming a national preoccupation to separate the various ethnic Jewish communities and groups who have arrived in the Promised Land. Broadly speaking, they're divided into two classes and categories: European Jews and those that have come from America, that constitute 35% of the population and who completely dominate the economic and political life of the State of Israel, and the Oriental Jews from the Middle East and the Negroid Jews that make up 65% of Israel but are at the bottom of the economic scale. Now the Oriental Jews and the Mongolian Jews that accept that they do have some characteristics of Jewish features that are definitely of a different race, and they carry with them the remnants of their religion. And of course, the areas of Israel operate all the farms and they operate all of the areas of industry by hestadarot, and they place people of the mixed ethnic groups into kibbutz farms. Well, these kibbutz farms predominantly then have Oriental Jews in them, and they have Negroid Jews in them, and they're starting to rise up, and they're saying, we're the majority here, and why should the European Jew live in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem? Why should he be investing his money, and we do all the work, when this is a collectivist society, and they're Jews, and we're Jews, and therefore they should work on the farms, or we shouldn't have to work at all. So therefore, they're having trouble here. Now that these Jews are stirring up the Negroes, the Negroes are rioting, and they're having riots over there, like the Jew starts over here to stick the Negroes on us. But over in Palestine, he's getting in trouble with these Negroes, and they say that the Negroes have a witch doctor area of religion. Now the European and American Jew, from the modernist to the Orthodox Jew, they have a one God who predominantly is their God. And they are Talmudic, and they believe that their rabbis have written the Talmud, which is the scriptures. Well, it says here that the Oriental Jew does not recognize the Talmud at all, nor does most of the Negro Jews. And so now they're having real race problems because they're ethnically different, but they do have something in common which they do recognize. And world kahilas, through the endless centuries, have organized Oriental Jews or Asiatic Jews, or permitted all Jews to attend their assemblies, though they had nothing in common in the areas of religion. And so either the state of Israel is going to have to become a materialistic state, or a state that has no facet of its religion having bearing upon its national life, or one or the other of these groups is going to win out. Now, the fact is that the unemployment is increasing as Oriental Jews are refusing to work on the kibbutzes. The economic squeeze is now on, and the Negro is also joining with the Oriental. And in the long haul, the army has been one area as the least common denominator that makes all Jews of army age serve for 2 years in the army, and thus is bringing them together, hoping that they will somehow be reconciled. But this is quite a problem for the government. In the long haul, Israel, I feel, the problem of assimilation will be solved, but they admit it looks as if it will take two or more generations. Though the Orthodox Jew says that since these are Jews and that they do have something way back racially in common, that they could absorb them all into one race. Now, what do you got? You got the European Jew, the Talmud Jew. He's the economist. He's the fellow that stole our money. He's the fellow that landed over there. And, of course, they're Orientals, too, from one standpoint. They come from Asia. But the pattern is that they're fighting again. Now, if they had come from Abraham was called out of the land of Ur of the Chaldees. He was called out of the land of Ur of the Chaldees to be a separate people. God called Abraham out of the land of Ur of the Chaldees because Nimrod was mongrelizing his race. He was taking in the peoples of India and Asia and Africa into his harems. And he was advocating that the people also intermarry and that they worship a multitude of gods so that the world could become one and he could reign over it quite simply. Now, the reason why they had the Tower of Babel was because God had caused a great earthquake to shake this tower, and every man spoke in the language with which he was born, and therefore they had to get out of the city because the king would kill them if they didn't speak in their own language. And this is why Babel scattered people back again over the face of the earth, whereas they were coming together once then, before, under Babel or Babylon, in this one city. God gave it a great earthquake, and every man was screaming and crying out in his own language, and then they had to flee, because the king of Ur had said that if any man doesn't speak the language of Ur, he's to be put to death. And now it put the people up and scattered them, see? And each one was speaking in the language of his mother. So this is again showing you that they came from all over the world. But when God said to Abraham, now you get out of the land of Ur of the Chaldees, now he got out of the land of Ur of the Chaldees, and even Terah, his father, came out, who was prime minister, and dwelt in the land of Haran, and then they went on from there, and of course God was preserving the very finest, the very highest type of the line of his race. Of course, Abram was 100 years old when he begat his son Isaac, but he believed God. He never doubted him when God said that it could be done, and that he would have a child. His wife Sarah was way past years, but she begat Isaac. Now, when Isaac was of age, remember that God said to Abraham that he guided Abraham, that he called Abimelech, his servant, and he said, "You put your hand on my thigh and swear by me that you'll get a bride for Isaac from among our own people. And you're not going to get a Canaanite, you're not going to marry a Hittite or any of these people." And the servant did this, and he went out and he got a bride for Isaac from among his own people. And so then again, remember that when Isaac took Jacob aside, and he said, now he says, "You go to thy mother's people, and you take a bride from among thy own people." And that's when he went to work for Laban and got Leah while he was after Rachel, so forth. Now, the thing is that in the operation, God was selectively breeding the very highest line of his race and preserving it accordingly. Now, if the Jews were descendants of Abraham, they'd be one race. The children of Israel today are one race. We may be different nationalities, but we're Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, Nordic, Basque, Lombard, Germanic. And the 31st chapter of Jeremiah says, "I'll pour out my spirit on them, and the house of Israel and the house of Judah are going to be Christian. They're going to recognize me. I'm going to put my laws in their hearts." And today, the people that are Christian and have fulfilled this are all members of the white race. And this is quite obvious. Now, if they were Israel over there, why, they'd all be white, one race. They wouldn't be the light, dirty tan of the Orthodox Jew, or they wouldn't be the yellow of the Chinaman or the nigger or any of these others. So where do you get these people? Well, Jesus told us where they came from. They were of their father the devil, and the lust of their father ye will do. They fallen angels that begat an unassimilatable offspring, and they begat them into all these races. And this is why they have some features in common and some characteristics in common, and they don't know quite what it is, it says here, but they realize they do have something way back in common, even though they're of different religions. And so this has always been true. The Luciferian capacity to create mystery Babylon and to use his sons to carry out the fantastic program of control of the political, social, and economic life of the world, and their attempt to even war on Christendom with this, is outlined in the book of Revelations by Christ to John. But when he says, when this time comes, he says, "We reveal who ran Mystery Babylon, we're going to reveal that it was thy merchants, it was these men who called themselves the great men, that were the merchants of earth, who he said had crucified or put to death all the bleeding offspring of the saints of the Most High God and the prophets." And of course, Jesus said to these Jews that in Matthew that ye are guilty of the blood of all the righteous slain, from Abel to Zacharias, the son of Barachias, whom ye slew between the horns of the altar. So we have this rather clear. So here you have they're fighting even now over the racial differences, and Israel is, "Hero Israel, the Lord thy God is one Lord," and then God's call for Israel to remain separate because if they didn't, he said, "You'll not only not worship me, but see, they wouldn't have the Spirit, because we receive the Spirit which is of God. We can propagate the household of the living God through which His Spirit flows. But there is no Spirit that will cohabit in the darkness." In other words, in this hour, only the flesh produces, and there's no spiritual life in the child of a mongrel offspring. And so this is what this establishes. This piece in the time, it doesn't realize how well it comes in at this hour, because it proves that they're coming from all colors, and therefore they're not the seed of Abraham, and they're not Israel, and they're Israeli, even though they need this place as a headquarters to carry out their functions. Of course, the Dead Sea has the mineral resources of the whole world are virtually tied up in the Red Sea as far as wealth is concerned, potash and these things.
Under the setting of Isaiah, it says, "All flesh shall be saved." That are these part of them, or are these excluded?
Whether or not they will or will be included as the begotten flesh of Lucifer, or whether they'll have to fold back into the hosts from whence they've come, this is a question, because, you see, they were not here in the foundation of the world to begin with. They are the only mutation of its kind, say.
There is no place in Scripture for them.
Well, I don't know. We don't say that. We just say that there's not a specific place in Scripture for them. In this time, and in this era, there is no place for them. In the ages to come, what God will do in His grace, we don't know. So we've got another question. We know that if Lucifer bows the knees, so also would the offspring spiritual seed bow the knees. Eddie?
Well, the era of mixture of the true Israelite and the addiction, the plague girl of Abraham. Are they considered a mutation or a monogal offspring?
Well, now, again, the Egyptian is almost absorbed, say. And in the course of time, kingdoms have come and gone until he's pretty much absorbed. The Arabs today of Ishmael make up the Bedouins, and they make up the Iraqi and so forth. And today the peoples of Egypt that have settled there have, in the late periods again, after the fall of the pharaohs, and the kingdom was once kind of conquered by the Marmadukes, these people were Negroids. And this was during one of the areas of debauchery, and there were practically no Egyptians left but Negroids. The Egyptians of today are mostly all Arab peoples anyhow. In fact, there's very few pure-blooded Egyptians, and one of them is the king line. The king line is relatively pure, having gone back and tracing itself way back, and a few of the royal dynasties have been around the line of pharaohs for a long, long generation. But they're practically all the pure Egyptians there are. And I guess he's run out. He spent his life in Monte Carlo. He didn't die.
Were these early Egyptians originally of white
descent? No, they were never white. They were a light tan. They came from the planet. Another question?
Is the dark Indian of India, is he related to Israel?
No, the dark Indian of India is not related to Israel. There are Aryan Indians over there that are related to Israel. In other words, they are. You see, Israel goes back to Adam. Israel doesn't stop. It goes back to Adam. And in fact, Enoch was told, "Thou art my Israel." Seth writes that he holds, "We are the Israel of God. We are God's issue, ruling with Him in the earth. We are destined to build His kingdom." See? So when the Sethites came from the high Seth, they spread out in the earth, and they went over into the areas of India, and they were the coming of the Aryans. And they even built these observatories like they built up in the Himalayas and Burma and so forth for the measuring of the stars. And they knew that Messiah was going to come too, because this was one of the things that Enoch had written in his volumes after he'd had his heavenly experiences, his trip and so forth. And that when the Aryans became quite powerful in India, in fact, they ruled India for a long time. But of course, India was a mongrelized program. Luciferian sons had sowed the darkness of Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and Kali. Hinduism was one of the most vicious of all religions. Though the peculiar thing is that the Aryans produced the caste system. They came in and they saw this evil, and they said that these people were untouchable, and it was the Aryans that called themselves high caste, and it wasn't a religious factor at that time, other than that they were the children of God, and they knew they were, and that they were the white race. And there is much concerning the ancient past of India. And when the Mongol hordes eventually came in, why, the white Aryans fought and fought and fought. And eventually they lost their power and throne because of the tremendous weight of the Mongolians. And they fell into areas of possible light idolatry to a degree. And then there were Aryans that didn't, right up to Jahanagar, who had built the Taj Mahal, was an Aryan, And so the Aryans were a separate society, and they are white. Now, if you look up in the Encyclopedia Hindu, you'll see that they classify him as a race rather than a religion, but they should classify him as a religion. And they put him over in the Aryan column because his head and features and everything else are like the Aryans. Well, this is because the Aryans were white, but they never were Hindus. But in the course of time, many of them had been absorbed and most of them were killed. But the fact is that therefore there was a very light caste Indian over there, and the very light caste Indian has all the features and aspects of the Aryan, because they practically absorbed the area of the Aryan, except for the real high caste Aryan, which would never permit this. And of course, they were white, just like Jahanagar was white, and of course they are some of the fairest of the Indians of today. And but there are very, very few of them, and there are some settlements of them scattered here and there in India, and they have a lot, and they don't mix with the rest, and they're generally financially much better off than the rest, too, and so forth, but they're only small smatterings now. And, of course, they shouldn't have dwelt with this in the land. It was all right to go up to Burma to set up Stonehenge type of observatory and so forth, but they were in a misguided realm to establish colonies in India at that time, because you're bound to be absorbed and overwhelmed by the sheer weight of people. They should have stayed with the rest of their race.
You know,
yes?
We were here about the pre-Aztec culturing of the race and how... I know you mentioned how some of the American Indians were white. Were they left over from the Viking landing or something?
I don't know. The first place, the Maya civilization is very old. It went way, way back. Like the Inca before them, which were, and though some Incas still continued, there's a lot of things that are antiquity and mystery about it. But when Manasseh, 800 years before Christ, sailed across the waters to the westward and went to sea in ships, he came into the Caribbean Sea. And they taught when they came why their ships and came and landed in the Caribbean, and the Mayas were on the shores where Panama and so forth were, and they saw these white men and they called them Quichi, which means gods, white gods out of heaven. And the Manasseh people that arrived there, they taught these people the Bible. In other words, they taught them what they had of Old Testament teaching. They taught them about Noah and they taught them about all these things. This is why today that some of the clearest and most pure Bible stories of all time are found in Mayan writings down there, where they have been taught these things by the Quichi. And they talked about the coming of the Quichi. Well, the Quichi settled in Mayan cities with them, but they kept themselves apart and so forth. And so in this peculiar situation, when they moved in, why it was always a significant thing that the Mayans were ruled over by the Quichi, and the Quichi, but they accepted it. The Mayans were never a warlike race to begin with either. They had entered into no war. Now there had moved in a lot of Oriental and Asiatic Indians. Or they, shall we call them Indians, because they were called Indians, that had come into the west coast and into this area. In fact, they moved down into the Tuapec in Mayan cities, and they wanted to conquer them, and these people went into the cities and shut the doors, and they closed the walls, and the Asiatic Indians knew some things. They knew that they could gather sulfur, and they got some of it in Arizona and other places, and they built great piles of sulfur around these cities. And they set fire to it to bring the Mayas out, because they were going to kill these people, take their possessions. But the Mayans had built tunnels out of their cities that took them out beyond the enemy. And these tunnels, they went out, and the white men, which were of the tribe of Manasseh, which were the Quichi, they led the Mayas northward, and this is how the Tuapec society was formed, and later the Aztec society, which was largely descended from Maya. But the Quichi were white men. Now they, of course, separated into the areas of Arizona and New Mexico, and the white Cherokee and the white Apache were the tribe of Manasseh. This is also true in the East Coast about a period of time that sets in for 700 and 800 years after Christ. The Scandinavians came over with their Viking ships, and they came to the mouth of the St. Lawrence River. And they built a tremendous city there, and they built it like a stockade, because the Indians, they discovered, were not friendly. And they even built forges there and forged great ironstone axes and so forth, as they used to in Europe. And one of the things you'll note is that they still find these forges in the areas of the iron ore facilities around the Great Lakes. And now the Vikings, in 1000, this is when Leif Erikson had come over. And remember that with these Vikings held to their cities, but the Indians were gathering, the Six Nations gathered, and they laid siege to these nations. And so, in one of the traditions, which they do still possess, why these tribes of white men came out in the night. The Indians didn't fight at night. But they came out at night and came out of the cities to go tribal. And they fought several successful battles. Now, the Narragansetts, of which King Philip was one of the heads, these were Scandinavians. They had blonde hair, blue eyes, and so forth. In fact, Pocahontas, who was the daughter of King Philip, was married by John Smith and taken back to the English court. And inside of 3 months, she was as fair in face and in her eyes. She was blue-eyed, but she was as fair of skin as any of the women in the court, because the tan was just a tanning like anyone else would tan, and it bleached out, you see. Narragansetts were not Indians, actually. They were white men. The Senecas were white men. The Mohicans were white men. The Delawares were white men, you see. But we have the majority of the Sioux were white men, though there was absorption and a bad marriage in which a portion of the Scandinavian, the Asiatic Indians were taken into one Sioux tribe, and this did, and they were much like the Eskimo, and they produced a kind of a solid, slow Sioux. But the Sioux themselves were white men. In fact, they were some of the most brilliant fighters, and they manipulated the areas of their tribal wars with intense brilliancy. In fact, Sitting Bull, who took care of Custer, his whole tribal group. Only one of the seven nations that he commanded didn't come originally from white men.
The Mandan Indians brought them white.
The what?
Mandan Indians.
Oh, yes. Well, there's quite a few sub-tribes and quite a few names to these sub-tribes.
Is there any relation to these things to the Bible and to the Zodiac? I heard it said that the head of the woman, the head of the line, was the indicated the beginning and the end of the Zodiac. Is this true?
It could be, but the fact is that the incumbent line with the human head was built in place by the same ones that built the pyramid. There is a passage that connects the two. There is a temple beneath the Sphinx that has three pillars and 10 pillars, showing that the destiny of 13 tribes, out of Joseph having two, which was still to come as the eventual source of the kingdom. There is much that remains in Coptic Aramaic inside the pyramid that proves again that the Egyptians never built it. But the incumbent line with the human head was again the sign, like the entire gospel message of the stars that was bestowed on Enoch, and that Moses as well knew, because he was taught this when he was raised in the temples of On when he was in Egypt. And of course we know that Enoch, who knew this, and Noah knew it as well. The gospel message of the stars were a constellation message, and it's a pictorial message. Of course, it's too much to get into tonight, but it starts with a virgin and ends with a lion. A virgin shall conceive and bear a son. Thou shalt call his name Emmanuel, to the lion of the tribe of Judah. And all of the signs of the zodiac and all of the houses of the zodiac all fulfilled definite facets of this message. And so, to this degree, why the incumbent lion with the human head was a symbol of the same power that would be the capstone on the pyramid, which we place on the pyramid with the all-seeing eye on it, on the Great Seal of the United States and so forth. But where it has always been in the heart of ancient masonry and so forth, the incumbent eye on the top of the pyramid became the chief cornerstone, as it did also in the scriptures, "Oh, you living stones thickly framed together, grow into a holy temple unto God, and behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone," and so forth. And this is the and to whom coming was undesigned, and the chief cornerstone is what Peter also refers to. But there's much to be said. I have volumes in my library on the Sphinx, just the Sphinx alone. Another question?
In Zechariah 14, it refers to verse 5, "You shall flee to the valley of the mountain, for the valley of the mountain shall reach the place of disaster in Lassa and Azal in the King James." Where is Azal?
This is across Palestine in the Negev. This is, and his feet shall stand in that day on the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem, and the mountain shall cleave in the midst towards the east and towards the west, and there shall be a great valley, and half of the mountain shall be removed from the north and half to the south, and so forth. and it shall be an earthquake such as they haven't had even since the days of King Uzziah. All this is referred to as part of the judgment on Palestine. Don't think for a moment the Jews are the chosen people where they should set themselves up for a rather sad awakening, because I don't want to be in Palestine when that whole land is leveled out into a great plain and fresh water comes out from under the lower escarpment of Jerusalem. And it says at this time that the Dead Sea will become a freshwater lake, and the whole area means that this will rise, and it also means that its potash bottoms will be washed out, see? The catastrophe that will envelop that land is a judgment on that land and the abomination of the desolated that stands in it. It's nothing God does for a people called Israel.
Is there a fault line running directly?
There's a fault line right through the middle of it. The fault line goes from there to Tel Aviv, and it'll dump half of Tel Aviv into the Mediterranean Sea and level the other side out like a plane.
Is Azal then near Tel Aviv or east of Jerusalem?
Azal is the name of Lucifer. So there's some significance there.
Did you
find out? No, I'm not going to. Another question? What is the question?
Could you kind of backwards it once before? I'm not familiar with the baptism of the Holy Spirit.
Well, it takes too long.
This is probably a long subject too. Could you sort of delve into the four horsemen of the apocalypse of the verse of the third woman on a pale horse, you know, going forth and the one on red horse and so forth as well?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a long subject, too. However, it systematically does cover conditions that will occur, we see here now. And he beheld a little white horse, and he that sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. But this is the symbol of the false peace movement. It has a bow in it, but it doesn't have an arrow. All it does, all the string pulling operations, and he that sat on it has a bow, and a crown is given to him, and he went forth conquering to conquer. But they're false beasts, and they have no lasting value. The second beast, I heard the second beast say, come and see, and I saw that the horse was red, and power was given unto him, that sat on it to take peace from the earth, and they should kill one another, and they were given unto a great sword. This, of course, is the horse of world communism, and it moves out to conquer and destroy. And I heard the voice of the third beast, and lo, he that had it was a black horse, and he that sat on it had a pair of balances. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts saying, a measure of wheat for a penny, three measures of barley for a penny, see thou hurt not the oil and the wine. And so this is again a area where the balance hand, such as Mussolini and areas of fascism move forth, and to balance and to conquer in an area. But when they came forth, in fact, one of the things that Mussolini said himself was that thou shalt not hurt the wine or the oil. These are the two most vital facets for all Italy, is oil and wine, olive oil and wine, the grapes and so forth. And it did stretch forth with great power. And this is a quick summary of what it stood for. But and then I heard the fourth war, and of course, out of it, with the Jews trying to suppress this area, well, they brought forth a war that engulfed the entire world. Now, we come to the fourth one, and we have the fourth beast, and it said, come and see, and I saw a pale horse, and of course, death and hell follows after him. Power was given unto him over the fourth part of the world, and this is the Chinese, the Asiatic communists and hordes, as they move out for the areas that are contemporary to Armageddon. Their host, a Chinaman is actually a real life person, majority of Mar, and the pale horse is light in countenance. And a Chinaman is lighter than most white men, but he's an off color cast, but still he is. And of course, this here again, you have this one, and the battle that he fights with, of course, and there's hunger and death, and they kill with the sword and so forth. And of course, they've never had enough to eat. Starvation has always been the thing that has controlled China through the ages. But this fourth horse does take in the peoples of Asia and China, and they're part of world communism. And of course, the this is what it talks about: the false pieces, the rise of world communism, and the rise of the right with fascism and Nazism and so forth, eventually forming a great force from which emerges a great war, and then eventually world communism being swept into the ranks of world communism, coming back now through the areas of Asia. And there's quite a lot on this, but this will take quite a lot of time to go into it. Another question?
In Revelation 11:3, I will give power to my two witnesses. They shall prophesy 1,260 days. What year does this start from?
Well, days is a year. It's not even important to this degree. We're past this as far as prophecy is concerned. The two witnesses are church and state, and they're in the heart of Israel, and they've come out of the Renaissance, and this is it.
What year did it start from back then?
Oh, I don't know. I can't give you the exact year it started from.
It wasn't from the same one that Daniel prophesied then?
Well, it could be. It could be interrelated. Another question? Do the two witnesses of church and state symbolically carry forward the destiny and the prophecies of God? And these are two witnesses. That's just as you have the witnesses in the book of Ezekiel, or rather in the book of Zechariah. Have time for another question? Yes.
But do you think the Arab, this is also a theology of it, but do you think the Arab states were in under communism or anything?
No, they were forced there by the United States. We had promised them during the time that Kermit Roosevelt and others were in Arab relationship as consuls and embassies and so forth over there. And we had promised the Arab states that we would see that they had sufficient weapons to defend themselves and so forth. But when Israel Ally came into being as an abortive power, and with all their influence over the politicians and their control of money and everything else, why, they made us back down on our commitment to the Arabs. And so the United States, complying to the pressure of world Jewry, backed down on their commitment to the Arabs. The Arabs saw that Israel Ally was going to rise up and it was going to conquer them, and they didn't have any weapons, and they were perfectly justified, because when Israel Ally invaded Suez 10 years ago, we saw that she would have, if they hadn't had any arms, they would have been totally wrecked. Even while they were holding the line, why, Britain rushed in, France rushed in, and eventually the United States. In fact, Mr. Eisenhower, who wanted to be a president of peace, was very, very irked by this. And he did discover the one thing that sent them home. He froze every dollar that the Jews had in every American bank and said that every asset that the Jews had would be frozen unless they would never get it unless they got out of Egypt. And the Jews just folded up and went back home again. You just squeezed their dollar and you hurt them hardest. But we did not supply the Arab states with the weapons that we promised them. And the result was that they turned to Russia, and Russia was secretly in league with Israel. Now, she supplied weapons, all right, to the Egyptians, but she supplied them with less and less ammunition, and she cites that she's building up a surplus for her military, and she's going to supply them again with great areas of ammunition. So Egypt and Syria received the tanks and the planes and the guns and the artillery, and they just got a limited amount of ammunition to practice with. Until 7-9 months ago now, Norma Ammunition Company inside of Sweden signed a secret contract with the Arab states to supply them with ammunition, and 7 months ago they started supplying with ammunition, and they shipped mountains of ammunition into the Arab states just the last 7 months. But they were even beginning to fail, and Egypt was beginning to fail because they didn't have ammunition, but the Russians had sold the arms, and they dealt on the Aswan Dam business and all of this. But right now, the Russians are running the Aswan Dam, and the parts that are completed, and they're putting out energy and power, they're already running it, and the Egyptians are being pushed out. So this is one thing that they, as far as the Egyptians and the Arab states, do not like the Soviet Union. They don't trust her, but they have to depend on her to some degree because they have so many arms and so much from her. But at the same time, Russia is moving to the north end of the Suez Canal with a vast fleet, a tremendous submarine fleet. Jane's Book of Fighting Ships, by the way, which is coming out now in just a month or so, cites that she has more submarines than the United States and Great Britain and all the Western powers, and that she has been producing these right along. And she moved a vast area of her fleet down to the lower end of the Red Sea, where you enter the Red Sea, down where the Gulf of Aden is and Yemen and so forth. A large standby fleet of Russian ships moved in there just last week. So that can get hot at any time.
Well, on one news commentary, he said that the Russian paramilitary ships outnumber all other nation ships in the world. It seems strange the Russians encourage some paramilitary operation and here they suppress it.
Well, of course, the Jews suppress it here. The commies are infiltrating and the Jews spread communism in this country. But as far as Russia is concerned, she's been building vessels ever since World War II, but she's stepped up in the last 3 years tremendously. Plus her air force, she has a terrific air force, and she's transferring now, every 2 weeks she's transferring 100 MiGs to the North Vietcong, so she transfers 1,000 MiGs to the Vietcong. Well, we couldn't transfer 1,000 planes to anybody and have any left.